Good evening, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lindsay, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Please, everyone, check your cell phones and make sure they are either on off or on silent. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now, I'd like to introduce our speaker. Her name is Piper, and I can't wait to hear what she has to share with us.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Piper, and I am an alcoholic. And I am just as nervous could be. But I am here. That's new for me. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, someone asked me to do this, I might say I would and not show up. Right? But I'm a different person today, so if I commit to something, I show up as best I can. But I have a pretty, I guess, extraordinary story before we get started on how I actually ended up being tonight's speaker. I was at the Roundup in July, and Tim ran up to me and my sponsor and was like, "Hi, how you doing? So good to see you again. Didn't you speak at the Blue Chip meeting?" And I was like, "Well, no." And then he said, "Well, you should, right?" And he gave me his business card, but that was cool for me because I was like, that's my will. I don't have to show up if I don't want to. But he said, here's my card, call me. You know how it is when you're back in the day, when you're hanging out, you meet somebody, you don't give them your number, you take theirs, right? So I said, well, this applies in this situation, and it was just a case of mistaken identity, right? So I saw Tim's card maybe 30 days later, and, I just kind of pushed it aside and said I'd get to it. And maybe 60 days later, I get a text message, call Lisa. And I'm like, call Lisa for what? Because, when you get certain text messages and there's no details, right? Somebody usually wants something. And so I called Lisa, and it's so funny because Lisa did not say, would you, could you, right? She just said, I have two dates, the 8th or the 12th, right? So I was like, if she had said July of 2023, that would have been cool, right? So I took the latest date. But, the good thing about that, the blessing about that is that today the company that I keep has my best interest at heart, And so Tim doesn't even know me, but he met me and he didn't realize it, but he was moving in God's will, I think. And he got me outside of myself, right? And then Lisa did the same thing by following up and asking me to get outside of myself and do something that I don't normally do. So for that, I thank you for your service. So anyway, I just heard that I'm supposed to tell you how it was, what happened, and how it is today. So I'll try not to. Do y'all share in this meeting other people? No. Okay. So, but anyway. So I'm a native of Atlanta, and my parents were young professionals, and they had a bright idea, and I'm saying that facetiously, to get married. And they did that, and about 3 years after they were married, they had another bright idea to start a family. And, within a year or so later, they had me. 2-3 years later, my mom had another bright idea, and she said, I'm out of this. And she got a divorce. And so my life totally changed, and I don't remember much about that union. except for my father. I think there was a very close connection between he and I. And I can remember him coming home from work, I assume, every day looking for me, and we played hide and seek. And I enjoyed it. And, you know, when you get older, you think back on stuff like that. And he was a good dad in those days because, I mean, I would hide in the exact same place every time. And he would put forth the effort to really look for me, right? And I really enjoyed that. And the other thing that I remember, which is notable for me, which is probably traumatic, was him being home, and I walked out of my room, and I couldn't have been any more than about 3, and he was in the shower with his suit on. And my mother was, like, keeping him in the shower. And I remember the shower curtain kind of being between them, and, you know, he was trying to keep the water spigot off of him. And it was disturbing for me, and I knew something was definitely wrong, because when I was in the bathroom, I was naked, right? And my daddy was fully clothed, but I had no understanding for what was happening at the time. But I know today that she put him in the shower because he had been drinking, and he was drunk. So anyway, they divorced, and everybody moved on. And life with my mom was actually a good life. She was a good mother. She was a, Lord knows, she was a disciplinarian. Jesus. I told her, I said, you know, if you had been a parent today, I would have called 911, right? And she was like, that would have been the last call you made, you know? But she was, my family, I grew up in a place that people call now SWATs, and it's called Cascade Heights. And it's a very proud community. And when I say that we had a village to raise us, we had a village to raise us. All of the last mayors of the city of Atlanta came from my neighborhood. The one that's the mayor now actually grew up with me. So the belief systems wasn't just in your house. If you went to the grocery store, wherever you were, as a kid, people were going to ask you, well, how is school? You know, what are your grades like? You know, what are you going to be when you grow up? It was that kind of stuff. And there was no escaping it. And I was talking to some of my friends recently, and I was like, you know, I didn't even, they were such good con artists, I think, that I didn't even realize until about 10 years ago that I didn't have to go to college if I didn't want to go. But the narrative was elementary, you identify, elementary school, middle school, high school, and college. And so I was third generation educated, and I didn't know that I had a choice, that I had anything else different that I could do. And my mom was funny. We were considered to be middle class, but she was always making sure I understood that we were poor, okay? And we can't afford for you to be stupid. We can't afford for you to be dumb. You know, she even told me once, she was like, listen, I gave you a name with 5 letters. Just in case you arrived and you were a little slow, we figured that you could handle 5 letters, right? So my days, I had a friend who asked my mom some years ago, well, how did you get Piper to be so disciplined? And I thought she was going to say, oh, well, Piper was just a good kid. She just followed instructions. And she said, conditioning. And I was like, you know, conditioning, that's what you do with dogs and animals, you know, and instructors. What do you mean, conditioning? But it was true, because she was a school teacher, and so her habit was to go to work, come home, she'd do her lesson plans or correct papers for students, and she'd give me work to do too. So it really created a habit, right? And I'm saying this to you because I think that each of us here is the sum total of everything that we've experienced, our attitudes about it, and how we've responded to it today, right? So some of the things that I've gone through have been really good things, and I carry those good things with me today, and she gave me those things. So, you know, very early, you know, 3, 4 years old, she'd be doing work, I'd be doing work, and I really thought I was helping her. But it set up a habit or conditioning, as she would say, of go to work, come home, do your homework. So she never had to tell me to do my homework, right? I was very active. I was an only child, and she didn't believe in idle time. So I started acting and dancing at the age of 5. By the time I was 7, I had done my first play at the Alliance Theater called The Miracle Worker. And I did two or three, four more. And some of the people that I actually acted with are actually famous today. And anyway, so I enjoyed that, but she was really clear. She was like, now listen, this is what you call extracurricular activities. You will not make any money doing this, all right? And once you graduate high school, you got 4 years. Get in, get out, become employable, all right? So this is just extra stuff for you to do. And I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot about other cultures. I learned about competing with myself and not others. It was a very good environment for me. And then somebody from New York came down, saw me. I was really great. They wanted me to dance in Buckhead at this other place, and then... So anyway, I did all of that, and I did commercials, I was featured. Some of y'all might not be old enough to remember the Mickey Mouse Club, and I did all that stuff, and it was a really, really great life. Now, that was on the good stuff on that side. On my dad's side, he never followed the divorce decree. He showed up when he wanted to show up, and the only thing that I heard most times was, he's drunk. Okay, so just go on out and play and do whatever. And in my household, I don't know about today's kids, but during my time, children were seen and not heard, right? You couldn't talk about your emotions. You didn't have anything to do with that. So somebody says to you, well, he was supposed to show up. He didn't show up. He's probably drunk. Don't worry about it. Go on outside and play. Well, what do you do with that, right? What do you do with that? So you carry that with you. But I can say this, on the times that my daddy came to get me, we had a ball. Now, on that side, this was the outdoors family, right? My father had a camper. He had a boat. We would either go to Lake Allatoona up 75, or we would go to Panama City in Florida, or we would go to Port St. Joe in Florida, right? And he and my uncle would ski. They started teaching me how to ski. My grandparents would join us. It was great. Now, there were a couple of occasions where he went, took a girl with him. They'd get drunk. It'd be an episode. You know, and I wouldn't tell because I knew if I told, he already wasn't coming like he was supposed to. If I told, then he wouldn't come at all. You know, or my mom would say, no, she can't go. And then, you know, kids don't think about safety and security. You know, you just think about, that's my dad, and I want to be with my dad under any circumstances, right? So, and I'll say this, and with him, he conditioned me too. Now, my father was a chemistry major, mathematics minor, or the reverse. And his thing with his conditioning was he always wanted me to be in math and science, which I ended up being. But anyway, and I do this to this day sometimes. We go through the grocery store because we always had to buy stuff. And I have to add up whatever was in the cart before we got to the counter, right? And I get a dollar if I got it right. He didn't believe in credit cards unless you had an emergency, so he always paid cash. So if he paid the cash, I had to tell him how much he's supposed to get back, and I get another dollar. And that went on my entire life. So he was the guy that always talked about 10% of your savings, invest in what the Lord makes no more of, which is real estate and land, right? And so I got those good lessons. But then there was the dysfunction. And at some point, I realized that my dad wasn't drunk all the time. My father was what you call a binge drinker. And he may drink for a week and not drink for 10 years, right? And then he might drink for another week and not drink for 5 years. You know, that's sort of how it went. And so what I deduced as a kid was, then what's happening all the rest of the time that he's not showing up? That must mean that he doesn't really love me, or he doesn't want to spend time with me, or I'm just not a priority, right? Now, I didn't have anybody to talk this about, but I'm just saying that I don't think I'm unusual in coming up with some assumptions that you make about people, yourself, and life as a kid that really aren't true, you know? And so sometimes they are, though, but anyway. And so I felt abandoned. I felt like not a priority. My father never came to, and I had a lot of graduations. Any of the shows I was in, he never came to any of that. And I was hurt. I was actually devastated by his, you know, non-participation. And kids find out, oh, what happened? Your daddy didn't show up. You know, I can laugh about it now, but as a kid, that's not funny. Oh, your daddy didn't show up today, right? And it'd be really, really hurtful. And my mother would have what I call episodes. And to this day, I think I'm still working on that, and I might be in a little bit of denial, you know? and she would be just as normal and just as wonderful, and then there'd be this big blow up. It was unpredictable, and I never knew what the blow up was about. So me, my deductive reasoning, I was like, well, if I got in trouble at school or if I did something, then I had my own phone in my room, because back then they had the two-way, and they didn't want to get out the phone, because, you know, as a teenager, you're calling everybody all the time. And so I had my own phone. So punishment was always, you know, take your phone and you can't drive, right? And so I'd do something that would be the punishment that was normal, but these episodes were something different. And she would be very mean, and sometimes she'd be violent. And it was tough. And it was hard for me to deal with because I didn't have anybody that I could share that with, right? So now, so I had that part with her. I had the abandonment with him. And then, because in the Atlanta public school system at the time, we didn't have Tyler Perry back then, right? And I was the one and only. You know, and there were a few others scattered around, but we were very few, and we didn't have social media. So if anything got out, you were either on TV or you were in the newspaper, and I was doing both. So I was like this little star child for the Atlanta public school system. And in my eighth grade year, I barely went to school, but it was easy because my mom was a teacher, and the teachers would send my work home, and I'd get my work done, and that's what we did. Because at the Alliance Theater, some of the shows were during the day. And kids from all around the state would come to the shows, right? So I had to be there. What I didn't know was that sometimes teachers would use me as an example. Well, how can Piper do all this and she's not even here? Well, that ain't my problem, you know what I mean? I'm just doing, you know, but that's the kind of stuff sometimes they were saying. I get to school one day. Back in the day, they used to have, I think they still have it, the TV week that comes in, and it was real big. And they posted in that glass window. And Lord, I was trying to duck and move away because I didn't want to talk about that because I wanted to have some normalcy, you know, somewhere, which was at school. Well, you know how it is. People see you in the limelight. They might not like you. You might look like you have a little bit more than some other people. They don't like you. You know, the teachers give you credit. And let me tell you, I was accustomed to applause, and when you're in plays and you're doing that kind of stuff, you always want to see what the critics have to say about you. Thank God it wasn't social media, right? We just had critics, and I'd always look for that. We read the paper. Everything was always good, so I had all these strangers and all these people, a lot of them that didn't look like me, that enjoyed me, liked me, appreciated what I brought to the table, right? Then I go to an environment where everybody looks like me, and I get a whole lot of pushback, and I don't like yous. And so in the ninth grade, I was the president of the class that year. Then they had me as the orator for the coronation. What eighth grader does that, right? So I got flagged for that. And Lord, let me tell you, the worst day of my life at that time, I was running for Miss Ninth Grade, and I was about them. I wasn't even a buckle. I'm probably 13 or 14. I looked like I was six, you know. And this other girl was running against me. You know, she was voluptuous, honey. She just was everything. She had her little tight dress. And Mama sent me to school looking like Goldilocks, right? And she walked down the aisle. And, I mean, she had her strut. And the crowd went, yay! So in my mind, I was like, oh, I got this. You know, they're going to stand up and give me a standing ovation. Lord, when I started my strut in that Goldilocks outfit, they booed me so bad. I had never in my life been booed. I walked on out the gymnasium, and the teachers could see the horror on my face, right? And they grabbed me and they took me to the principal's office. I just could not stop crying. They were like, look, you got to go somewhere else. This is not your environment, right? So they called me. I said, I can't tell my mama because I didn't want her to have an episode, right? And say it was me. So I'm like, I can't tell my mama nothing. But I didn't tell them that. I said, you know, you guys have to tell her. So I ended up going to Northside, which is School of the Performing Arts, and it was a better environment. Still had some of the same kind of stuff going on, but a better environment for me. And so that was pretty much it. Those were the early days. Now, alcoholism. I saw three people drinking that I can remember. My father was the binge drinker who, when he would drink, he'd tear up the whole house. Okay?
But we never lost anything. So to me, in my little mind, I equated materialism with being okay. I did not tie the alcoholism to the destruction of the mind, the body, the spirit, the family, right? But because I didn't feel like I lost anything, I thought everything was okay. My mother, I never saw her drink by herself. But I did see her drink socially, right? Her girlfriends would come over. You know how they have the bar carts now that are so popular? We had one of those in the house that stayed there with the alcohol on it. But they seemed to have a good time. So I knew if you are upset, unhappy, you can drink for a week, tear up your house if you want to. As long as you don't lose no money, you're straight. Okay? At my mom's house, you can drink with your girls socially, have a good time, still go to work, everything's cool. Then we had Mr. Luther, who was the neighborhood drunk. And he would come over, he'd drink, and he would play with us. And Mr. Luther had one tooth at the top, in the front. Everything else was bare, right? But I loved Mr. Luther. I had to get Mr. Luther a gift, because he was the nicest guy. And he would actually judge our contest. I mean, I love Mr. Luther. And I used to say, well, Mr. Luther, you just got to get a job, you know, because I thought he was the worst of them all, you know. And I don't know whatever happened to Mr. Luther, but those are my three examples, right? Now, God. My mom didn't go to church much. My dad talked about God more than my mother. And I knew the Bible because he gave me some kids' Bibles. You know, you used to go in the doctor's store and they give you one of those things for the kids. It's like 12 of them. So I read all of them. So I knew about turning water into wine and, you know, all of that. Feeding the village with the two fish and walking on water. You know, I thought it was great stories, right? And I thought that I believed in God, but I really didn't understand the application of it, you know. So one night I was driving and me and my girlfriends decided to go to a party. And we got a bright idea. Why don't we get some alcohol? Okay? So we went to the neighborhood. And this was stupid. We went to the liquor store in our neighborhood, in our village, where everybody else was going, right? On a Saturday night. And I get out the car. They had sense enough to stay in the car. I get out the car, and I'm looking at them, and I see all of them duck. I turn around. It's my homeroom teacher from high school. So she says to me, what are you doing over here? And I said, oh, I was coming to get some potato chips. She said, well, why didn't you go across the street to the Amoco? I said, because I didn't need gas. She had also gone to high school and college with my mom. So she was like, listen, if you don't go and get back in that car, I'm calling your mom. That's how it was. And you just couldn't get away with anything. So anyway, I was like, all right, cool. They still ducking. I'm the only one that she sees, right? So I get in the car, we drive around, we stay out for 10 minutes, come back, wait to see somebody that looks young enough that'll go for it, right? So we all put our little money together and we got some MD 2020 and Lightning Creek. Yeah. And we drank first and we went to the party, and when I tell you, I was free. I was like, this is it, I am home. What? And everybody liked us, and we were so cool because we were cute and we dressed nice and I had hair then, you know. We were all of that. And I always remembered how that felt. And I always remembered how that felt. And I felt like a different person, you know. And I was changing at that point. I felt targeted a lot. And so I'm really kind of easygoing and kind of nice, but I picked up a bravado, like a mask. I wanted to be mean and wanted to be the curse and I wanted to be the Joan, because I figured if I can, you know, a good offense is your best defense. If I can keep you off of me, then we don't have to deal, right? And so I sort of started to become somebody that I really wasn't, right? So anyway, fast forward, y'all know I had to go to college because I didn't know I'd have to. So I did that. I went down to UGA. That was crazy. If any of you have ever been down there, Millage Avenue was a smorgasbord of nothing but frat and sorority houses full of kegs. And that was my place to be. And all you had to do was just walk up and down the street with your cup during football season. And that's what I did. But I ended up having my first blackout while I was in school, but I didn't realize that that is what it was. And then I ended up with a reckless driving that actually came up when I was trying to get my global entry or whatever, and I got it. But it was funny. So I was really fortunate. Thank God for that judge, that he probably felt sorry for me. Little student probably said down here at the University of Georgia, little black girl, she need everything she can get to get out of here. We're not going to give her DUI, right? And so I got that, whatever, that reckless driving. And anyway, life went on. I graduated. I started working. I couldn't keep a job for nothing. Anybody, the industry that I'm in is mostly male-dominated, and it's mostly people that don't look like me, okay? So in order for your voice to be heard, you got to be the best, and you got to talk a little loud, and you got to hear what I say, and I mean what I say, right? So I didn't keep a job. But I was a bit entitled because I was also spoiled. And if, you know, if I go to Miami and kick it because I said something on my job and they fired me, well, then mama, daddy, y'all just pay the rent. You know, that's just how I thought things should go. So I really didn't have many responsibilities. I had a car at 16. I got another car. My parents paid for it. They paid for the insurance. And I wouldn't even go and get the oil changed. You know, just entitled and trifling. And drinking. And it all came to a head one night. And I really was not feeling, I knew something had to happen. And at that time, my father was traveling back and forth for work, wherever he was going. And he called me. He wanted me to do something. And he could, you know, when you're drinking, you can hear the slur in the voice. And he could hear it. And he made some comments that I didn't particularly care for. And there was a girl there with me, and when I got off the phone, I said, I got to go get some help. And she said, do you have any more money? And I said, no. But I was lying. I said, no, I don't have any more money. She said, well, baby, you automatically a rehab. And you know how you have that moment of clarity? And I was drunk, but I was like, can you say that again? And she said, well, if you don't have any money, baby, you automatically in rehab. And I said, well, what the blinkety blink happens if I find some money? She said, well, you automatically out. And in that moment, you remember back in the, well, some of y'all might not, but back in the day, they had this commercial with a frying pan and an egg. And they said, this is your brain on crack or drugs or something. And I was like, oh, Lord, I got to get some help for real, because she was about 10 years older than me, right? And I said, Lord, because if I end up like you, that's a problem. So I called a few people that I knew, and I was like, listen, I've got to go. I can't go in the neighborhood. I've got to go somewhere special. I lost my job. I don't have any insurance. I've got to go somewhere. I got to get some help. Because the only place I knew, we didn't go to shrinks in my neighborhood. That was out of question. Never heard about anybody doing it. The only place I knew people went to hospitals if you were bleeding. And you went to AA if you just couldn't handle if your life was hurting, right? So I went where my daddy went because I had been with him. And I went to this place called Fox Recovery, and I was trying to find somebody that looked like me, and finally I saw this girl that came in. I was like, oh, yeah, I can kick it with her. You know, she's cute, look like she got some game. You know, we can roll. And one night, there was about 14 of us, and one night, they had told me, the counselor says, you know, you're going to have to go to a halfway house. I was like, no, I don't, because that's where criminals go. I, you know, I don't need to go there, you know. So they were trying to tell me, though, that once you go through this detox, you really need to go somewhere to get some help. And I was just in defiance, okay? So they got in this circle this night, and they said, we're going to talk about the things that we did before we got here. So I was like, okay, cool. But some said, from the looks of it, you need to figure out which way they're going to start this conversation, you know, because it don't look like too many of these folks been working. And I didn't know what to say, but I want to fit in. I want to be liked, right? So when I kind of figured out which way they were going, I got at the end so I could hear what everybody was saying and I could, you know, pick up. So they got to me. I heard all the stories and it was fascinating. And I said, they said, well, Piper, what did you do, you know, when you ran out of money? I said, I was a booster. And they said, well, what did you boost? I said, everything.
They said, where did you boost? I said, everywhere. You know how lie get good to you? I said, I was so good, I was about to go international. And so right about that time, this girl said, the one that I told you that I thought we were kind of similar, she said, bleakity bleak bleak bleak, you a lie. You know, so I clutched my pearls. And I started to stand up because it was 14, 13 of them and one of me, right? And I knew I was about to be jazzy at the mouth, so I was going to have a quick exit. So I just started standing up, and I was like, how dare you? I'm not like y'all. And I went through the whole spiel. Y'all know it. And she said, you're not like us yet. And I swear to God, I had never heard yet sound like that before in my life. That was the only thing that they had said that caught my attention. And I said, well, hold up. Let's talk about that yet. I said, well, what do you mean? And she started telling me a story. When she got to the end, she said she was somewhere one night with a guy. They were doing drugs, and the guy had OD'd. And she had come to the facility from jail. And I said, oh, my God, that's how you got locked up. You called the cops, and they took him to the hospital, and they locked you up. They were looking at me like I was out of my mind. And she said, oh, no. I picked up what was left, and I got out of there. I don't know what happened to him. And I said, are you serious? She said, that's insanity. Every last one of us in here was just like you one day. You know, it's called obsession and compulsion. Let this be a new way of life for you. We did it for you. You don't have to. And I said, well, you know what? Just in case what you're telling me is true, I think I'm going to go to the halfway house. And that's how I got to the halfway house. And that's how my recovery started. And that was, I got sober January 27, 1995. Okay, and I started that process because I said the operative words were, just in case I'm one of you, right? Then I'm going to try what you said for a little while and get a little relief. And that's the truth of it. And I did that. And I was able to not drink for 12 years. Okay? But that was about all I did. I found my sponsor who is here with me tonight when they talk about attraction rather than promotion, right? And I was talking to a girl and for about a year, and she would tell me she was talking to this woman, and this woman would tell her this stuff. And I was like, man, that sounds like some good information. What's her name? And I had never seen her before in my life. And I got her phone number, and I said, hey, I don't know you, but I know you. And I'd like for you to be my sponsor. She said, well, come on. Let me take a look at you. Now I'll just tease it. Let me see what I'm working with. She sounded a little crazy. But anyway, but thank God that I did that, because even in all that trauma and drama, which is what it was, I knew I had somebody that I could go to that had a working knowledge of this program, that when my butt was on fire, when I chose to do something right or take a suggestion, I had somewhere to go. Okay? So I did that. I stopped making meetings for a long time. But like I told you before, I thought everything was okay because materially I was progressing. I was staying on my job. I wasn't talking so much. I was making money. I was doing all the things that I had promised myself and my family that I would do. But I was crazy. I got married twice and divorced twice. Trauma and drama. I had a good one. I got rid of him for the bad one. Right, and had the nerve to tell the not so good one, if you don't drink, you keep a job, and you don't have affairs, then that'll work for me. You know, that sounds like what it sounded like before I came into recovery, right? Daddy, if you do what I need for you to do, Mama, if you just do what I need for you to do, everybody else, if y'all would just applause and do what I need for you to do, I'll be all right. You know, and that's what I told him. The crazy thing about it was the one I had before that didn't do none of that. He kept a job, was a good guy, was a sweet guy, but I got rid of that. Now I'm saying, oh, that's what I want. Insane. I was out of my mind. So I ended up drinking in the 12th year,
And it's just interesting how we, apples don't fall too far from the tree, you know, and you don't want to be like some of the people that you knew, but you end up being like them. And I take a drink, and I wouldn't drink for a couple of months. Wouldn't get drunk, that's how I started, right? Then I take a drink. This went on for about 6 or 7 months. I was so crazy. My solution to my problem at the time, because my life was hurting, was to go on a fast. That was my solution. So I went on a lemonade fast with cayenne pepper, right? Because I was traveling back and forth from work, and I'm eating all this restaurant food. I need to cleanse my body. And I went on a fast, and guys, no lie, I couldn't do this today. If I wanted to, I wouldn't lose weight that fast. But I lost 20 pounds in 15 days. I think not realizing that you can kill yourself, have a heart attack, you can crash, right? Started crying on a Sunday, just couldn't stop crying. Everybody was like, why are you crying? I don't know, I'm dead. So I went to the doctor the next day, and the physician started looking at everything was off in my body. Electrolytes were crazy. It was reckless. And then she asked me this question. She said, well, why did you go on the fast? And I said, well, two reasons. One, I've been traveling, and I've been eating a lot of restaurant food, and I need to cleanse my body. And the second one is I feel a little fat. And she looked at me. She said, where do you see the fat? And I said, well, I tried on the shirt the other day, and it had a little ripple back here. And she said, describe it again. I said, a little ripple. She said, okay, I want you to go to Ridgeview tomorrow because it's too late. And she said, I just want them, no problem. We just want them to do an assessment. And I said, okay, I can do that. So I get to Ridgeview. I walk in all dolled up. They start asking me questions. The guy says, do you ever think about killing yourself? Here I go. You know, sometimes I just drive down to north of Grumman in Louisiana to go to work, and I take my two Yorkies with me, and when I go over that bridge going to Alabama, I just roll down the window because, I say to myself, I should just run off this bridge, but I'm going to roll the windows down in case I change my mind on the way down and me and the dogs can swim out. And the guy said, I'll be right back. I was joking. You know what I'm saying? But it was true. I mean, like, I ain't going to kill myself, but it do cross my mind, but me and my dogs are going to swim to safety. You know what I mean? If I roll the windows down. He said, I'll be right back. He came back in that room. They said, click, click. And I had to stay there for a whole week. And the good news was they do all this testing and stuff. And they said, well, neurologically, there's nothing wrong, but you are an alcoholic. And my shrink said at the time, she said, you need to take care of yourself. And I was like, yeah, I am doing that. And she looked at me and she looked at my husband at the time. And you know how old women sometimes give you the information without giving you the information? And she looked at me, and he was tall. And she looked up at him. And she looked back at me and she said, take care of yourself. And so it wasn't long after that I took my last drink. And I woke up that morning and I was sick as a dog. I had never been sick like that. And my hands were shaking and I could see the tremors, and I knew then who I was, and I picked up a book somewhere, and the book said that normal people don't have tremors. And I said, well, hot damn. It ain't just in case no more. It is. You know? But there was a lot of freedom in that, because at that point, I knew who I was, and I never looked back. Right? And I got up, I called my sponsor, told her what was happening, went to a meeting, and I started the journey all over again. And I was all right with that, because it took what it took. You know what I'm saying? And then the first 12, I just didn't think I was one of y'all, right? And that was a journey, but now I know. So after that, I mean, it's been gravy since then. Life has happened. Me coming to terms with God and coming to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity came in dribbles. I knew I had to get out of that relationship, and one day he walked into the house, and I said, Because I never could get that unmanageability part of step one. I got the not drinking, but the unmanageability part, but I had a chance to look at it and I saw all that mayhem, you know, in the midst of material progress, right? And I was like, this has got to say, you know that song, A Change Is Coming? It's like that was my theme song, you know, A Change Is Coming, man. And he walked in and I told him, I said, look, this, we at the end of the road, this is it. And he said, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. And it was almost as if it was a recorder, a video that went back and came forward. And he wasn't sitting there, but my father was sitting there. And my father was saying, I'm sorry, baby, I'll never do that to you again. I'll jump out of an airplane backwards for you. I'll fight a diamondback rattler. And then my father went away, and he was there. And I said, oh, my God. That was the answer. This was a repeat. He wasn't the problem. I was the problem. So for the first time in my life, I was open-minded. I was open-minded, and I realized that it had been all of my will. And not one time in any of that time had I ever said, God, what is your will? So it was a little bit easier for me at that point to roll into step three, right? Because now I know any disturbance, any annoyance, any problem, I don't care what it is. It's me. And you know what I do when I don't know what to do? I do a couple of things. I say the serenity prayer. At the end of that prayer, I say, your will, not mine, be done. If I'm still a little antsy, I pick up the phone and I call my sponsor and I said, hey, this is going to sound a little crazy, but this is what's going on. And you know what she said to me? That happened to me too. You know what I mean? So now in my life, I get into, I'd already gone through the steps before, but application and what you read in the book are two different lives, two different lifestyles, right? And some of my problems, anger. That's number one. My self-centeredness, my ego, and self-righteousness. Oh, Lord. Every time I get mad at somebody else about doing something, if I pause for a minute, guess what? I've done it too. You know, so then comes the compassion and the empathy for somebody else. How can I hold you that accountable when I'm not holding myself that accountable, right? Then you start to realize that some of this stuff just ain't feeling good. Like, when I cuss you out, I get a quick fix. I told him. I told her. No, you didn't. You just discredited yourself, you idiot. You know? And so I don't like to do that anymore. And then here's the kicker. I might need you one day. You might need me one day. Now, if I've said some crazy stuff to you, how can we even reach? I just heard somebody say that tonight. How can we even reach out to each other and be of service and help each other when I just waste the time on something that don't even matter, that we both are guilty of, right? So I try today real hard when it comes to, I'll say this, where my shortcomings are. I just really try to breathe for a second and don't do anything. And sometimes I realize there's some things that I can't get rid of so easy. So I pray about it. If it doesn't change, I pray about it. So anyway, it's been great being here with you guys. Thank you for letting me share.
That was awesome. That was so good.